This podcast of The Exchange is sponsored by Northeast Credit Union, helping their members save money through free checking accounts and refinancing of auto, home, and personal loans. Northeast Credit Union, encouraging you to discover the difference at necu.org. Federally insured by NCUA, Equal Housing Opportunity.
And the Dagoba Group, a global diversity and inclusion consulting practice with specialties in unconscious bias, leadership dynamics, and client engagement. Authors of the book, The Inclusion Dividend. More at thedagobagroup.com.
And Dartmouth Hitchcock, creating a new model for healthcare where leading health systems collaborate to improve care for all of us. A sustainable system improving the health of our communities for years to come. Information at imagine.d-h.org.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. There's been a lot of angst in America about college debt, stories of a whole generation of young adults putting off buying homes and starting families because of that huge financial burden. And so, in 2013, President Obama announced a plan to rank colleges and universities based on whether they were a good deal.
What we want to do is rate them on who's offering the best value so students and taxpayers get a bigger bang for their buck.
Now, 2 years later, the administration has released its college scorecard. It's a lot of data, but not really a rating system, which it turns out is pretty hard to do. Still, many analysts say there is value in looking at slices of that data before you can sign that giant tuition payment. And so today in The Exchange, we grade the college rankings, the many ways to judge whether an institution is worth the cost. Let's hear from you. Call in The Exchange number 1-800-892-6477. That's 1-800-892-NHPR. Send an email to exchange@nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. Our guest is Kwok Trong Bui. He is a data journalist with NPR's Planet Money team. His recent article is Obama Won't Rate Colleges, So We Did. There's a link to that article on our website, nhpr.org/exchange. And Kwok Trong joins us from New York. Kwok Trong, thank you for your time.
Hi, thanks.
Well, how are colleges ranked now, Kwok Trong? Everybody's pretty familiar with, you know, the U.S. News ranking, for example.
So it's really interesting. The way the U.S. News ranks colleges isn't kind of like when I heard about how they rank colleges, I was kind of surprised. What they do is they base it on like measures of reputation. So they go around, they ask a couple of academics from each school to like rank each other. So how good is Harvard on a scale of 1 to 5? How good is Dartmouth on a scale of 1 to 5? And they take all those numbers and they put them together. And it's like that takes up nearly a quarter of the weight in the ranking.
Well, that's pretty subjective.
Yeah. They say the reason why they do that is because there's a colleges have – they take a more holistic approach. It's like as if like they want to look at like – how each other feels about like the university, and there are a lot of different ways to like measure a university. So they say, well, you know, let's just look at each other like from a very general kind of holistic approach.
So how else do they do it, Kwok Trong? Yeah, go ahead.
Well, the next way they do that is through graduation rates and retention. So another roughly 0.25% is how often or how frequent do the students who go to that school, do they graduate? And on top of that, after the freshmen enter the school, how many of them return? The idea being that, like, you know, if the school isn't that great, you're going to leave after your first year. But if it's awesome, you're probably going to come back. So the more you come back, the better the school is.
Well, and higher education folks that we've talked to, Kwok Trong, they have sort of a love-hate relationship with these U.S. News & World Report rankings. You know, if they turn out low, they say, well, the rankings are flawed. And when they turn out high, they say, hey, look at us.
Well, it's kind of ironic, particularly for the reputation thing, because they're kind of just annoyed that their peers don't think of them as highly as they want to be thought of. So I find that very fascinating. It's not based on like any sort of performance metric because universities are so diverse and they produce so many different undergraduates. Another metric that they also use is selectivity. So like how hard is it to get into that school? Are the ACT and SAT average SAT scores high for that school? And is the admit rate low for that school? So this notion of selectivity is also very important to that. And then on top of that, the one thing that Obama actually really dislikes in a lot of these rankings, particularly for U.S. News, is that they measure how much the school spends, just in aggregate. Is a school spending a lot? If it's a school spending a lot, that means that, at least according to the U.S. News reports and reports view, that they're doing a lot of investments and there's a lot of stuff to offer students.
Wow, spending on whatever.
Spending on whatever. Facilities, faculty, pay, new buildings, gyms. You hear a lot about rock climbing walls at universities. And these are all different ways universities kind of compete with each other to kind of make themselves look better. But it's not clear whether or not this kind of spending actually makes students better off after they leave college.
Right. How does that help you? So that's where President Obama comes in. And there he is 2 years ago at the University of Buffalo in New York saying, I'm going to make this better. So what does he propose to do back then?
So what he proposes to do is he wants to use the data that the government already collects and unify it all together and refocus the idea of how we measure colleges from things like reputation and things like spending to in his mind, practical outcomes like, how much money are you making after school? How many kids actually graduate from your school? How much debt are the kids going to your school incurring? The government spends roughly as of 2014, the government spent roughly $164 billion in federal loans and grants and tax breaks to help students pay for school. And it's like he's trying to think of it as like an investment. And so the government, for every loan and grant the government gives to a student, that's like an investment the government is making in higher ed.
So results-oriented, the salary you get, after graduation, whether you graduate on time, whether you transfer to another school, more sort of hard-nosed facts and figures there.
That's right. Very, very, very practical, very, very realistic. And, if you're 18 or 19 or 20 and you're looking at these universities and you're allured by the beautiful lawn or the great gym or the rock climbing wall, you might not be thinking about, well, am I going to have a job after this experience? Am I going to have a lot of debt after this experience? How much debt am I going to end up with when I leave? And how much is going to cost me in repayment every month when I graduate? So these are the kind of like annoying, not fun, not sexy details that like Obama really wants to highlight.
Not good to put on the glossy cover of the brochure. So President Obama says, hey, if young people had better information, they'd make better choices. But you're getting to something important here, Quoc Trung. It's not clear that people make these choices just based on the numbers. There's a feel. I mean, we can sort of laugh about the beautiful campus or the rock climbing wall, but there's also, love that history professor. She's the best around, or that school is near the mountains and I love climbing mountains, or it's near my aunt and uncle and they're going to help me out. So there's a lot of subjective stuff in there too.
Yeah, and I don't think in any way he's proposing that, people only go by the hard numbers. It is, I think the idea behind the scorecard is like, well, there are a lot of schools by mountains, so why don't you pick the one that makes most sense to you?
The phone number for you to join us here in The Exchange, 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. Today in The Exchange, we're digging into the Obama administration's recent college scorecard. And as we'll find out in a moment, it's not exactly the ranking or the rating that was promised 2 years ago, but there is a lot of data in there. We're looking through some of that, and you can join us with your questions and comments. What do you think is the best way to rate or rank various colleges and universities around the country? We'd love to hear from you. 1-800-892-6477. Our guest is Kwok Trom Bui. He's a data journalist with NPR's Planet Money team. He's been looking at this. And Kwok Trom, let's go to our listeners. Steve's joining us from Nottingham. Hi, Steve. Go ahead. You're in the exchange. Welcome.
Good morning. I'm a college professor. And what I'm going to talk about is what Laura was talking about a couple of minutes ago, what I call the fit. I don't care about mountains and climbing walls. What is really important is when you go to that campus, and I urge you to go to a campus and walk around and be shown around by students, or go stay there for a weekend or sit in on a class. And when you feel that fit, when you feel at home, when you feel that connection, that is much more important than any rank.
Well, and Steve, let me ask you this, and I'm really glad you called. First of all, where do you teach?
I teach at Daniel Webster College in beautiful Nashua.
Okay, yeah, and I hear you on the fit piece. That's definitely important. There's no point in hanging out for a couple of years at a place where you don't fit. But given the financial concerns, Steve, how would you urge students to assess that, given that people don't have unlimited amounts of money?
Okay. I can give you an example from my son, Brock, who just graduated from Northeastern cum laude. He had many choices in the Boston collegiate system. He chose Northeastern because it fit him, because he liked the co-op program. It meshed with what he wanted and the experience learning as well as a campus. And I would say, it's really crazy, but I would go much more with the fit than the money. I think ultimately if you like the school, you're going to learn from it and you're going to get a good job because you've learned from it and benefited.
Okay, Steve, thank you very much for calling in. And Kwok Trom, it's tough to assess this, isn't it? It isn't just about, you know, dollars and cents.
Yeah, and it's interesting what he brought up because to my knowledge, I don't know if there's any sort of reasonable metric to like kind of measure fit, right? You kind of have to approach each. You have to think about like what kind of school you want to go to and what kind of environment you want to be in, and the things you like and the things you don't like. This data just helps you decide whether or not among the schools that you think are reasonable and fit you, which one would probably be the best for your pocketbook.
Steve, thank you for calling in. Again, the number 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. So you talked, Kwok Trom, about what Obama was trying to do, get less of a squishy assessment of colleges and a more sort of hard-nosed, results-oriented, you know, the salary upon graduation, the debt, the actual cost versus the sticker price. But when this was announced 2 years ago, a lot of college administrators were up in arms. They said, no, you can't do this. What were their problems with it?
So clearly with wages, there's a big problem, right? Because if you're a school that graduates a lot of liberal arts majors, the average among your graduates in terms of salary is probably going to be lower than that of an engineering school just by the chosen profession of your graduates. So I think there are a lot of college presidents that were afraid that if the government stepped forward and started ranking schools or rating schools, that there would be pressure on their liberal arts programs to turn out more engineering students, or it would be harder to have as diverse academic environment that they want.
So the problem was, you know, don't rank schools or rate them based on how much graduates make, because obviously, an engineer is going to make more than a school teacher. So they said that was unfair. Did the administration pull back then on that particular ranking?
Yeah, they did. They did pull back. So what they did in this data, which is interesting, is they showed, and you kind of have to dig deep for this, but they show you at each school the share of students that graduate in each kind of specific major. And they didn't attribute a specific ranking. Actually, what they did was they wrote this policy paper, which is kind of funny. And this kind of funny thing where they they gave out three different ways that they would rank schools if they had to. But they weren't. It's like it's this thing where, like, you know, we're not going to rank schools, but if we did, this is how we'd do it.
So what did they
and
say?
So they chose three different ways. They outlined three different metrics. One is value, and within this like proposal, they had things like debt and the repayment rates and graduation rates and wages. They had an idea to rank schools by income. So, you know, how much money you'd make after you graduate from schools. And then I think from the administration's point of view, the most important one is mobility. So how many students entering your school are first generation college students? How many students are in your school receive Pell Grants? How many students in your school what is the cost of going to your university if your family's roughly low income? And so it's really interesting. They did everything but rank schools.
Well, and the income does seem to be a questionable ranking, not only for the reason that we talked about a minute ago, Kwok Truong, the idea that, of course, one type of job is going to make more money than perhaps another type of job. But also, you know, some people care less about making more money. Some people might say, I love my job. I love the people. So who cares? Also, different parts of the country, you know, Los Angeles, New York is a lot more expensive than different parts of the country. So it almost seems like, why are we so focused on this income measurement?
Well, you know, so I graduated with a math major, and here I am in public radio. So I totally hear what you're saying about, like, not making that much money. But I think the key thing is, like, are students getting value out of college? And so they also have this really interesting measure within the data set that asks this very important question. Are your graduates earning more than the average high school wage? So the average person that only graduates with a high school degree makes roughly $25,000 a year. So how many of your students are making more than that? If they're not making more than that, then in like the most reasonable, lowest denominator respect, like, you're failing your students in terms of adding value to their education. And so I think there is a range in which you can measure success with income. But like the lowest bar, I think they say, is, are you making more than a high schooler?
The other important piece of data in this that people were looking at and that President Obama tried to look at is the idea of how much debt students graduate with. I'm wondering if college administrators, you know, pushed back on that as well.
I think they are. And I think for reasons that might be kind of surprising. For instance, if like the amount of debt that students graduate with vary significantly, and not in a way that like corresponds to our traditional ideas of like of prestige, for instance. Like if you look in the scorecard and you look up a school like Dartmouth, the median debt of students who graduate from Dartmouth is $1,100, right? But if you look at schools like the University of New Hampshire, the median debt for people who graduate from that school, it's $27,000.
Wow, big difference.
So it's a big difference, and it's surprising because Dartmouth, its sticker price, it's very high. It seems like a very expensive school. So why is it that more people are why is it that their graduates are graduating with less debt than like a state school like the University of New Hampshire?
And that probably has to do with financial aid and all that.
That's right. So it brings back to this really important point that that this idea of net price, right? So like what net price is the cost of education that the students actually pay. So what you do is you take the sticker price like in your pamphlet, and then you deduct like financial aid, grants, and all these other extra benefits that students may get from the university or from the federal government, and you come to like a specific price. And the interesting thing about this price is that it's different for every student.
Right, because everybody has different financial availability. We will definitely pick up on that in just a moment. Stay with us. This is The Exchange on NHPR. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. How to rank higher education is our focus, given the Obama administration's new college scorecard, not exactly the rating system first promised. Our guest is Kwok Trung Bui. He's a data journalist with NPR's Planet Money team. His recent article is Obama Won't Rate Colleges, So We Did. There's a link on our website, nhpr.org/exchange. You can join us now, 1-800-892-6477. What do you think about this question? Given all the concerns about college costs, college debt, what information is useful to rate or at least compare schools? And just as important, what information isn't useful? Call in the exchange number, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. Again, 1-800-892-6477. And Kwok Trung, right back to our listeners. Jonathan's joining us from Dover. Hi, Jonathan. Go ahead. You're in the exchange.
Hi. I attended NHTI for computer engineering, and I was just kind of wondering where community colleges stood on this rating, because I chose NHTI because I started at 25 years old and I was working at McDonald's. I wasn't making a lot, but NHTI was very affordable for me.
You know, Jonathan, this is a great question. I'm so glad you called. And Kwok Trung, how do community colleges sort of break out in these various rankings that you looked at, whether we're talking about the Obama scorecard or some of the other rankings that you've seen?
So community colleges are really important. I think they're actually the key thing that Obama's trying to focus on in this college scorecard. Because like for a lot of schools are doing well and they graduate pretty good graduates. They afford them really good opportunities. But the key issue is that there are a lot of community colleges that don't do that. And so what the scorecard allows is like a lot of information on community college. Like the U.S. News and World Reports, they have a little bit on community colleges, but like the data there isn't that great. And the thing about how they do it is they rank on prestige, and like it's really much more difficult to rank on prestige in the world of community college. Moreover, like people who are interested in going to community colleges, I think they're more concerned with outcomes. They're more concerned with, like, how much debt am I going to accrue? Can I pay this off? Am I going to make more money from going to this community college than students who go to four-year colleges who might study history or something?
So this college ranking system that the president promised, and as you've written, it came out more like a bunch of data, a college scorecard, and some useful data, as you've said, Kwok Trung, but not really a rating. So you wrote an article called Obama Won't Rate Colleges, So We Did. Little tongue-in-cheek there, maybe. How did you do it? How did you rate colleges?
So we asked three really respected figures in higher ed to think about, like, in your perfect world, how would you rate colleges? And each one of these researchers, they have a specific kind of research topic or conclusion that they really care about. So one of the people I spoke to was Tony Carnevale, and he's a economist out of Georgetown, and his deal is earnings. The only thing he cares about is earnings. He actually told me, I'm like the show me the money guy in economics. And so the way he thought about rankings is just to look at, very simply, median wage, the average net price, and the percent of students who graduate in 6 years. And so that within that framework, that's the thing that he cared about. I spoke to another researcher. Her name's Amy. She works at the New America Foundation. The thing that she cares about is upward mobility. Within that world of upward mobility, she says, like, I care about students. I care about whether or not students are receiving Pell Grants, whether or not the price is low for families who don't make that much money, and whether or not there are a lot of first generation students. If you just look at just those two different rankings, it's really interesting because, like, Tony's money ranking is more of a consumer facing, like, how is this going to help me, right? If you look at the ranking, like, if I go to these schools, I'm going to myself personally benefit from this. But Amy's ranking is more of like a policy, like, is the world going to be better with these, with these schools? And so, like, no one's ever going to look at, like, very few people are going to look at these rankings and say, like, oh, this school is upwardly mobile, I should consider this school over a school that pays me more money. So there's a lot of different nuances without how school, how different researchers approach these rankings.
There was a third researcher, right? Kwok Tong, Peter Capelli. He had another take on how to rank colleges.
Right. And Capelli is really interesting because he's a professor of management at the Wharton School of Business. And his deal essentially is college a good deal? Like, he's written books on whether or not people should even go to college to begin with. He's sort of feeling like the whole notion of just going to college just to go is kind of wrong, and it doesn't apply to a lot of people. So his ranking is like, does going to the school make financial sense to you? And the data that he advocates for using is looking at default rates and looking at the share of students who are receiving federal loans, because the scariest thing about debt in higher ed is it's not federal loans where the rates are reasonable and quite low. It's private loans. So if you're funding your education with a lot of private loans, you're essentially saddling yourself up with debt that's pretty hard to escape and is pretty risky.
You know, Carnevale, the gentleman who focuses just on salary, he even admitted that, you know, it's limited. I mean, students who attend the top performing schools like MIT or Duke or Harvard are already go-getters, high performers, and so forth. You know, no matter where they go, they're going to do well.
Right, right. And I think the value out of this and the value out of the scorecard isn't just looking at, like, the top 10 or top 20, even though it's really fun to do that. It's really, let's look at, like, where schools rank in the hundreds, in the 200s. Are they doing okay there? And are you getting a lot there? Because, you know, if you go to Harvard, you're probably going to be okay. But it's a different conversation if you're going to, like, a middle-tier ranked school or, like, a state school. And the interesting thing about this, though, is, like, you – within the rankings that I've calculated, you do see some surprises. Like, schools like Babson is fifth within the ranking, right behind Stanford. Georgia Tech, right behind Babson at sixth. So, like, in these rankings, Ivy Leagues don't necessarily dominate. There, you can get really great deals at institutions that are less recognized.
Here's an email that came in from Sarah in Freedom. She says, as a financial planner, I urge my clients to be good consumers of college. I encourage them to set a budget for sending their kids to school, to determine outcomes they'd like to see, then to shop around for schools that are within their price range only. So this is a counterpoint to the gentleman who called earlier who said, you know, fit is the most important thing. Sarah says this helps parents and children alike to set reasonable expectations for their price point. Sarah says another piece of data I think it's worthwhile to understand is the average salary by major. We then do some rule of thumb budgeting. 1 year's salary after graduation is an appropriate amount of total college debt. So, wow, Sarah's really, you know, going through it piece by piece with her clients there. It's impressive.
She's my kind of person. I'm with her.
All right. Thank you, Sarah, for the email. Did you want to jump in, Kwok Tong, on that?
Well, the one thing that I will say that that really like clarified this to me is that, you know, when you go out and you get a loan for a car, when you get a loan for a house, there's a person that sits you down like a financial planner and tells you how much the loan is going to cost you over what time period. Like, that doesn't happen for school. When you apply to school, they tell you how much it's going to cost and how much you can take out, and then you click, and then you get that loan. It's so fast and so efficient, but in a way that really hurts, you know, students, because they don't really have a good sense of what this is actually going to mean for their lives after they graduate college. And Tony, he gave me this really awesome kind of tidbit, because when you approach college, the thing that matters for your income is your major, but the thing that's going to cost you, the thing that you're going to have to pay for, is your university, and those two aren't necessarily connected, right? And so you're trying, it's like you're paying for something before you actually, you know
what
realize what you're going to know it's worth. Because a lot of students, when they enter college, they don't know what kind of major they're going to enter or, you know, major they're going to graduate with.
Well, yeah, we talked about this earlier. I mean, the whole idea of worth isn't just, again, a dollars and cents thing. It's satisfaction.
It's everything.
So yeah.
But income does matter, because if you do borrow, you're going to eventually have to pay for it. I'm still paying for my loans, for instance.
Let's take another call. And Michelle is in Campton. Hi, Michelle. Go ahead. You're on the exchange. Welcome.
Hi. I think screens like this are great. I think it's one of those things that it just adds to the information that people can have when they're looking at universities. Because I was a history major from UMass, and I laughed, like, who makes money in history, right? And I ended up in social services, and the job satisfaction piece is huge for me. And I currently work as a pastor in Tilton, New Hampshire, and I'm in the process of founding a family resource because of access issues. And it's funny, because I'm going to meet a college student at Plymouth State University right now who couldn't find housing because she was a young woman who was pregnant under the age of 21, and the university had no housing for women like this. And there's so much more than just the numbers. There's access. Do they have family support? What are the comprehensive supports that can be put on in place in the background for people, as well as the hopes and dreams? I mean, the hopes and dreams are like kind of almost a moot point if they cannot have access to what education we have to offer in the state.
Sure.
So it's frustrating. But
Michelle,
Jessica Peel was on it, you know, finding housing for this young woman. But, you know, it's very frustrating, I think, when you don't have access to information like this to have an educated decision in the background going on.
Sure. Well, there's a lot of information in the College Scorecard, but as we're learning, you got to sort of jump into it and spend some time digging around. Michelle, thank you for the phone call. Let's take another one. This is Dave in Grantham. Hi, Dave. Go ahead. You're in the exchange. Welcome.
Good morning.
Morning.
My comment is that if I were the president, I would be concerned that I'm giving enough data to the population to make good decisions. But I think as an investor, meaning the government is a big investor in all of us, and expect some outcome to improve our overall standing in the world, that one of my biggest things that I'd be telling the education department is, you better find me a way to rank those colleges and universities so that I'm investing well. And that's the other side of the story that, you know, I think we've hit on all the other stuff, the fit and the dollars and whether you can be accommodated in your income bracket and so forth. But I think the government is a big investor, and really they need the data.
Sure, and this is a point that you made earlier, Kwok Truong, that the government, you know, does have a stake in this beyond trying to help young people out.
Well, what's interesting is that the government has already collected this data. They've been collecting this data for years now. The thing is, they've just been holding on to it, and it's been living like in several different domains. And this is the first time we're seeing it together and seeing it for the public. And I think the thing that this data will help do is help students make better choices. And if students make better choices and they choose schools that fit them better and fit their financial situation better, then naturally the government is going to get a better outcome. The government can't force you to go to any school, whatever school they want you to go to. You have to make that choice for yourself, and they're just giving you tools to help you make that best decision.
Well, as we look at this idea of how to fairly rate or rank institutions' higher education, let's hone in now on how New Hampshire schools stack up. And with us for that is David Brooks. He's a reporter with the Concord Monitor, blogger at graniteGeek.org. Hi, Dave.
Hello.
So you looked at this college scorecard that we're talking about with Kwok Truong with a New Hampshire eye. How did you slice and dice this data for New Hampshire, Dave?
Well, that was the hard part, because it is quite the data dump, and there is a ton of really interesting stuff in there that I didn't look at. So I decided, because I also cover business, that I'd try to do sort of a return on an investment kind of approach. So I looked at the salary, which is the average salary 10 years after graduation, and the cost, which is the average price of attending the school after various aid. And I found, not surprisingly perhaps, that most schools in New Hampshire, they have the salary is above the national average, and so is the cost. So the question was, which is more above the national average. And so I'm comparing, you know, I'm comparing comparisons, which gets a little confusing. But basically what I found was for most of the schools, the salary was above the national average, but the cost was even higher above the national average. So you could argue that for most of the colleges in New Hampshire, perhaps they weren't giving as good a deal as they could have.
So quibble or not with this whole idea of rating by salary, because again, our caller who's a history major,
absolutely,
you know, is going to make less than someone who majors in, you know, chemical engineering. Even considering that, though, Dave, it looks like New Hampshire schools are charging too much money?
Well,
can I pull that out from this?
I guess you could argue that. I mean, and I, boy, my story was full of caveats, and I realize that's a problem. So, for example, I point to Daniel Webster College in Nashua, which is very strong in the aeronautics field, and people who graduate and get into aeronautics tend to make more money than people who graduate with a history degree. So it has a pretty high average salary as a result. Does that reflect well on it? Yes and no. But what I found was that, let's see, it was Dartmouth, UNH, Manchester, and a number of the community colleges, looking back to that previous caller, including NHTI, they were the ones in which the average salary was better above the national average than the cost was. So you could argue that they give you a better return on investment. Whereas a number of the other schools, frankly, didn't. All the way down to the New England College in Henniker, which is a lovely place. I've drive through it a lot, and I've attended events there. And take a look at it here. The average salary was 4% above the national average, but the cost was about 70% above the national average.
Wow, now, that's a big gap.
That's a big gap. I mean, that doesn't mean the dollars wouldn't work out for you personally. And it's a reflection of the majors they do. And it's also a reflection for New England colleges. They have a lot of adult students at the graduation rate. So they're not entirely traditional body of students. That same thing came in for Southern New Hampshire, which is Southern New Hampshire University, which I was kind of surprised at a very high average cost, but it has all these online students that are not counted as single students. They're sort of lumped together. They're part-time students. So they lump together. I forget, you know, each part-time student is counted as 40% of a full-time student or something like that. So it's hard to make these comparisons. But nonetheless, it's a piece of information that a student or a parent looking at might consider.
Well, and here's a question I'll ask you, Dave, and also Kwok Truong. So I saw your article. I saw all the caveats. You know, adult students are different. Part-time online students are different. Students who need room and board, sort of that stacks up differently than commuter students like UNH Manchester is mostly commuter. UNH Durham is more of a traditional residential campus. I hear you. It's hard to make these comparisons. Maybe it's so hard that we shouldn't bother.
Well, I thought about that, and I did not rank them. And we have a chart which shows all the numbers and kind of let people look at them. And then you're right. I mean, and as you've already said, I mean, so much of what's important in a college is not quantifiable like that. But nonetheless, this is information that you need to take into account.
All right. Well, and Kwok Truong, last quick question for you. Same question. Should we bother, given all the caveats and concerns?
I definitely think we should, for two reasons, actually. One reason is, like, more information is better. And, you know, like, the more you can understand how much students at your school earns, the better off you are. Because a lot of these brochures, they're estimates, and you don't know if the estimates are comparable to other schools. So even if these metrics are kind of flawed, they're at least comparable from one school to the next school. But one thing I would also add is that it's a behavioral thing. People love rankings, and they tend not to think about this.
Love those
these data
lists.
Unless there is a ranking. Like, if your school comes up short, you're gonna want to know why. And then that's gonna compel you to take a look at the information.
Well, quickly, I'm gonna cut you off there. I do apologize. This has been great. Thank you so much for being with us, Kwok Truong Bui with Planet Money. We've got a link to his article on our website. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. We turn now to a national news story based here in New Hampshire. West Lebanon's Kilton Public Library last week drew attention for its support of the anonymous web browser Tor. The library had voted to use its extra bandwidth to support the project, but turned off the relay after local police raised concerns. We're going to spend a few minutes now looking at this story with Dave Brooks, reporter for the Concord Monitor, writer of the Granite Geek blog. He covered this story. And Dave, lots of questions to go through. I want to remind our listeners, too, that you can join us, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. So, Dave, what is Tor?
All right, what is Tor? Can I just say before we get into the geeky weeds here that this is one of my favorite stories, not only because it's an interesting topic, but because everybody acted like adults. There was this like intelligent discussion between people and they reached a consensus and nobody insulted each other. It was wonderful. I wish all news stories happened like that. Whether or not you agree with what happened, it was everybody behaved like a grown-up, which is very nice. So Tor, T-O-R, stands for the Onion Router. Router is in a way to send stuff around the internet. And onion, because it's a metaphor for all the layers of an onion, it's like the layer of protection and encryption that Tor can give you. As you said, it's a way to be anonymous on the internet. It's a system. It's software and protocols for hardware that can be used that way. And what's interesting about it, it's a free open source project, very similar to Linux. Many listeners will be most familiar with that, which is, so in other words, it's not owned by a company, it's not owned by the government, it doesn't belong to anybody, it doesn't have any set people that are making it work.
Sounds like Bitcoin.
yes and no. In terms of the philosophy, so it's this very libertarian-ish open source software. So what it does basically is it sets up lots of computers all around the world, and when you go online through a Tor browser, which the library did not have a Tor browser, it had a Tor node. Anyway, if you go online through Tor browser, it bounces you around all these volunteer computers, and as a result, nobody can really easily follow you. That's the idea.
Now, a couple questions for you, Dave. So earlier this morning in my little preview with Rick Anley, I called Tor a search engine. Someone called and said, no, it's not a search engine. It's a web browser. So I stand corrected. Thank you to that person. So what's the difference?
So a web browser is, you know, like your Firefox or Exchange or Chrome. It's sort of the window that you use to get onto the internet. And Tor has a web browser, and so when you use their window to get onto the internet, you do it via the Tor network. And the Tor network is all the computers that are scattered around, including the one now at Kilton Library, which bounce your signal around the internet and keep people from following you. A search engine be like Google, which is you can use a browser to get to it. It's a way to find stuff on the internet. And you can use a search engine inside of Tor. But it's almost I thinking of a browser as a window into the internet is a better way to do it.
Sure. And Tor, T-O-R, what does that stand for?
The Onion Router?
The Onion Router.
The Onion Router. I mean, yeah, geeks aren't always that great at acronyms, to be honest. So.
And we keep talking about this at the Lebanon Library because that's where the news came out. But could I use Tor at my house?
Oh, you can download the Tor browser and use it at your house if you don't want your kids to know what you're doing on the internet or if you don't want NHPR to know that you're looking for another job or something like that. I don't know. I mean, there's a million reasons to use it, and that's the argument behind it. So
that's the attraction.
That's the attraction of it. And one of the really interesting things about Tor is that it was developed by the U.S. Navy, and they still actually use variants of it because they want to be able to do stuff online without, you know, I guess it's not the Soviets anymore. I'm showing my age by thinking that, without the bad guys being able to follow them. And these days, the biggest financial supporter of the Tor project, which is a small, sort of a loosely organized group, kind of like the Wikimedia Foundation that organizes Wikipedia, the biggest financial supporter is the State Department, because they think that being able to go online anonymous is valuable in other countries for dissidents and for people who just don't want somebody else to watch them. They recognize the value of that. So you simultaneously, you have the government supporting it. The Navy created it and the State Department pays for it to a certain extent. And you have parts of the government that are leery about it. And that, of course, is law enforcement for obvious reasons.
Sure. And when we did our show on Bitcoin, one of the concerns was that illegal drug sellers were using it to,
And all sorts of nasty stuff happens on tour. There is no question about it. Child pornography is the one that usually gets brought up, because if you're trying to do child pornography, you don't want anybody to know about it, you use tour, you can. It's very, very hard for law enforcement to find you. But the counter argument is, well, you know, cars are used for bank robberies, but we don't ban cars. So, but that's definitely the argument, and that's why it was actually, as I understand it, I'm not absolutely entirely certain of what happened, but somehow Department of Homeland Security realized that the Kilton Library had signed up, had established a tour node. I mean, it wasn't secret. There were news articles about it. And they sent a note to some police department somewhere in New Hampshire, who eventually contacted the Lebanon Police Department, which just didn't know about it and wanted to find out more. And that's how the discussion came about.
All right. Well, again, you can join us. Lots to learn on this. 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. And Dave, Chuck is joining us from Lebanon. Hi, Chuck. Go ahead. You're on the exchange. Welcome.
Hi. This is Chuck McAndrew. I'm the IT librarian at the Lebanon Public Library.
Okay, the man in the news.
You're the man.
That's right. So I just wanted to talk a little bit about why our library got involved in this project in the first place, because some people may be wondering if this is where public libraries belong, if it's a space they belong in. And librarians have traditionally been very involved in issues of intellectual freedom and privacy. The right to read is something that librarians care deeply about, and we're in the digital age now, so the right to read doesn't just mean books on the shelf. It means access to information. We consider ourselves information professionals. So when Allison Macarena from the Library Freedom Project approached us with this idea, we thought this is a no-brainer. Of course, public libraries should be part of this. So we took it to our board, and they unanimously approved it. And then when law enforcement made their concerns known to us, we put the project on hold for a few weeks just to address the community concerns, and we overwhelmingly heard from our community that they also thought this was something that public libraries should be involved in, and they cared very deeply about online privacy and intellectual freedom. We received nearly 100 emails, and of those, only one spoke against the project, and every single person who spoke at our Board of Trustees meeting was in favor of it. So we really feel we made the right decision in being the first library in the country to do this, and we hope that a whole lot of other libraries follow very quickly.
Well, what were the concerns, Chuck, that you heard from law enforcement? And by the way, thank you very much for calling in. It's interesting to hear from you.
Yeah, so the law enforcement, just like David was just saying, was concerned about the potential criminal use of Tor. It does. It's a powerful tool for anonymity, and like any tool, that can be used for good or for bad. So law enforcement, of course, focuses on the criminal activity, and that's their job to do so. But I think too narrow a focus on this one aspect is wrong. You know, we need to look at the whole picture, and as librarians, that means we need to look at the fact that anonymity can protect whistleblowers, it can protect dissidents, it can protect people who are in domestic abuse victims who are trying to stay safe. There's plenty of people who are technologically savvy and can, you know, look at track people online. So, and I mean, even just common citizens, we don't need to necessarily be so dramatic. You know, I frequently use Tor just because I don't like, you know, Amazon knowing everything I look at. If I'm looking for a Christmas present for my wife, I don't want that to necessarily pop up with advertisements for the next time she's on the computer.
So what about the Department of Homeland Security, Chuck? Did they contact you and say, hey, we're a little worried, or was this more local law enforcement saying, let's take a look at this?
Right. So they didn't actually contact us at all. They contacted the Portsmouth Police Department, and as I understand it, I'm not completely familiar with it. I didn't receive any of these emails. They just saw a news article and forwarded a link to the news article, and then the Portsmouth Police Department just forwarded that email to our local police department, who then talked to us and our city manager about it.
Okay. Dave, did you want to jump into with Chuck? It's, again, real interesting to hear from him.
It is very interesting. And as I understand it, part of the reason you guys participate in this is you're already an open source, use a lot of open source software there at the library. So you were kind of like halfway there. So
That's correct. Yeah. Allison McCrina came up and did a training for librarians in our area at the Kilton Library in West Lebanon about how to protect patron privacy online, and while she was there, I was able to show off some of our projects. Like, we use completely open source software on our desktop computers for our patrons, so they're running Linux. Our staff side is completely on Linux, and we have a lot of we're active in the privacy area already. We have privacy enhancing plugins for our web browsers, and we like our default search engine is DuckDuckGo, which doesn't track you, rather than using Google, which does. So she saw that we were already very interested and active in this, so she thought it would be a good place to start as a pilot. And since we had the technological capability, since we were already running Linux, it made sense to do the pilot.
It was easy for you to do it, relatively easy. So, and by the way, for listeners who aren't sure, when we talk about open source, it's sort of the philosophy of the software is not owned and not controlled by any single entity, and other people can tweak it, can use it as they wish without necessarily cost or restrictions. So,
Chuck, one last question for you. You know, you're kind of going against the grain here, aren't you? I mean, the whole thing these days is Google, Amazon, Apple. Here's some more things we thought you would like to look at, or here's where you went last time. Let us help you figure out if that's where you want to go this time. I mean, in a way, you could say, yeah, I don't want them tracking me, but in a way, it's all about efficiency. I sure appreciate it when I type in a website and it remembers, you know, you went here last week and here you are again. So you're kind of going against the culture there.
So what we think about it is if you appreciate that and you want that to happen, that's great. But we want you to have the choice, and we want you to have the tools to control your information. We don't want, say, Google or Amazon deciding what information they keep. We want you to have the agency to say, I'm going to share this with you. I like this efficiency. I like this website remembering. But that doesn't mean that I want all these other websites to have access to the same information. Basically, people should control their own information, and what we're trying to do is give them tools to do so.
Dave, last question from you.
Well, it's more of a comment, and playing off what you said before, I think this is also a reflection of the increasingly important role that libraries, public libraries, are holding. Public libraries, really, the Patriot Act, the USA Patriot Act in 2005 is kind of what prompted them. They were really the first organization to push back against law enforcement, which wanted to be able to come in and take a look at whatever books we checked out. And now the Code of Ethics of the American Library Association says very strongly that, you know, we protect the library users' right to privacy and confidentiality, and pretty much period. And it's part of, I think, the role they have, that they are a computer cafe as much as they are almost a bookstore these days, so to speak, in the community. And I'm really delighted that they're bringing this argument and this point of view into the public so it can be part of the discussion.
Chuck, thank you for calling in.
All right. Thanks for having
me. Let's take another call, Dave, again on this story out of Lebanon and Tor. And Jason is joining us also from West Lebanon. Go ahead, Jason.
Sure. Thanks for having me on.
Sure.
I just wanted to call in because I was at the board meeting where the library decided to turn back on the relay. And it was really interesting because we got a really good and almost sort of spontaneous turnout from people locally who supported the decision. And the board read out the number of comments they'd received locally from people in support and in favor. And they only got one comment opposed to turning back on the relay. It was something like 30 comments in favor of it. So there was definitely strong support for doing this locally. And for me personally, the reason I support it is that I think we need to have really strong privacy tools in the hands of private individuals. You know, if you're willing to pay a lot of money, you can. Some of these tools are available commercially, you know, PGP, cryptography, but Tor allows this to be in the hands of private individuals who may have reasons for keeping some things secret.
Jason, what about the – let me just give you the other side there, and I'm sure you're familiar with this, that Projects like Tor do make it easier for child pornographers, drug traffickers, and so forth. And, you know, the argument might be we don't want to enable these folks. What do you think?
Yeah, I understand that entirely. What I said at the meeting was I understand the costs and the benefits. I do think the benefits are greater than the costs. There are other tools that law enforcement has. When you use Tor, law enforcement can see that you are using Tor. They can't see, you know, how you're using it. But that can be one factor among many. If they have other reasons to suspect that you might be involved in illegal activity, they can use the other tools at their disposal, so sort of classic policing tools of surveillance to figure out you know, whether there's something really there.
Okay.
So I don't think it really eliminates law enforcement's ability to track these crimes.
Jason, thank you very much for calling in. Dave Brooks, final thoughts from you? Other New Hampshire libraries might follow suit. What do you know?
Well, at the moment, I know there's at least one in Vermont that is talking about it. I wouldn't be at all surprised if other libraries follow suit. I don't think it's very expensive. It does require a certain amount of somewhat technical knowledge, but most libraries have a decent IT department. And on that last point, I do have sympathy for the law enforcement side as well. I mean, obviously, I've talked to cops, and it's really frustrating to have good idea that something bad is happening in your community and you just can't quite get the evidence to get to the bad guy because of this tool that is being brought around. And you can understand how law enforcement would be frustrated. I have read that the FBI has developed some ways to follow Tor traffic. The technical arguments are over my head. But nonetheless, you can understand both sides on this case.
Okay. Well, Dave Brooks, two interesting stories that you helped us out with today, Tor and then earlier comparing cost and so forth, value for New Hampshire colleges and universities. We really appreciate your time. Thank you for being here.
It's always fun to be here.
That's David Brooks, reporter with the Concord Monitor and blogger at granitegeek.org. The Exchange is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio. The engineer is Dan Colgan. Our senior producer is Ellen Grimm. Our producer is Faith Mikesell. Our volunteer is Priscilla Malcolm. Our theme music was composed by Bob Lord, and I'm Laura Kanoy.